High Desert and the great American Southwest. Glad to do all. Good evening or good morning, wherever you may be, from the rock in the west, the island of Guam, eastward all the way to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north to the pole, and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM. Good morning, everybody. My God, what a mess out there. We'll get to it in a moment. I would like to welcome another new affiliate, WHIS, in Bluefield, West Virginia, 1440 on the dial. Welcome to the network as we edge ever closer to that magic 500 affiliate mark. Oh, boy. Listen, we've got pre-feeds going on. I want to try and remind everybody of that almost every night. The actual show begins at, you know, whatever time you have now in your time zone. However, we now pump down the same pipe where you get it now, 3 hours of the previous night's show as a service to your listeners. Or, if I'm speaking to all of you, to you. So that radio stations can pick it up a little bit early and, you know, a lot of people fall asleep. We understand that. We're an all-night program. People fall asleep listening to us. A lot of times, you know, they miss a little bit of this or that. And so, as a service to listeners, we're now pumping the show down 3 hours early, which means if your radio station has a little hole they want to fill, there we are. And for you, you get to hear what you missed. Okay. It is the quickening. That's what I think I'm saying tonight, folks. The quickening is it's gone to a new level. It's almost hard to know where to begin. With the national news, the Dutch are now confirming tonight that they have foot and mouth there. Far from being contained, the foot and mouth disease that has devastated cattle herds in Britain gained ground on the European continent, with the Netherlands on Wednesday confirming its first cases. They are slaughtering incredible numbers of animals within, you know, like a couple of miles radius of every time they find it. All of them decimated. And it's still getting out. It's moving across Europe. So I'm sorry to see that news tonight. The other horrible news, maybe this is even worse for us, Greensboro, Vermont, you probably know about this by now. U.S. federal agents went to a farm early Wednesday to seize sheep feared infected with a version of the mad cow disease. 233 sheep have been seized. They will be destroyed, by the way. Department says the sheep imported from Belgium might be carrying a disease akin to mad cow disease. So, you know me. I'm a beef eater. I love beef. I'm not going to be consolable. If this horrid disease comes to America, and this is getting pretty close, folks, maybe it's here, you know, it's gonna be a situation where beef is may not be safe, and that's gonna kill me. I am your basic hamburger, steak, French dip, you know, if beef in any form, that's me. And I don't know what I'm gonna do. I'm not gonna eat lima beans. I'd starve to death before I ate lima beans. But this is serious for the whole nation. Really, really, really serious. And so I'm sorry to say, folks, the news is bad on all fronts. Foot and mouth is moving fast in Europe. And now mad cow might be here. Now, of course, they're going to kill these animals and do tests, and we should all cross our fingers, knock on wood, that it all comes out all right. They're warning about blackouts in California again if it gets warm. And now, tonight, The president is warning that New York City may be next in the blackout department. New York City. So in other words, it jumps across the entire country to New York City. And no doubt other areas this summer, they're warning now of gas shortages, you know, as in what you put in your car. Natural gas shortages, fuel shortages of all kinds. One of the factors at play here, obviously, is the cutback of 1 million barrels per day by OPEC. So I'm telling you, I don't know how it gets any worse. Well, it does. The stock market is crash-oling. I mean, it's crashing, folks. They don't call it a crash, but it's a kind of a long, delayed crash. Tokyo, I just learned, has fallen 248 points as we speak. 248 points in Tokyo. The Dow dumped another 233.76, closed at 94.87. Holy mackerel. The NASDAQ closed down 27.21 to end at 18.30. We're talking about a market that was at over 5,000. And with the Dow, we're talking a market that was at 12,800. I don't know, I think it did hit. Did it hit 12? I remember it hit 11. Anyway, look how far down, 94.87. So they're calling it a bear market. They're not calling it a crash. But it's kind of like a slow crash. When you start deducting 100, 200, 300 points per day, it's getting pretty serious. So, you know, as I look around me, with these animal diseases bearing down on us, financially, we're in trouble here, obviously. And I look around at the weather. It's horrible. Going to get worse. Things are speeding up a little bit, aren't they? So we'll try and keep you informed about all of this. They're going to test these sheep, and we'll find out if it really is mad cow. If it is, that's going to be a big problem for us. If it isn't, one, you know, can only wonder how long it will be. But they're seizing these sheep for, you know, a good reason. They think there is a significant possibility. And boy, I'll tell you, they sure haven't kept any of this under control in Europe. And that's why I'm so worried about what might happen here. I mean, think about it. They're slaughtering animals at an unbelievable rate there, and even with all the slaughtering going on, they're not stopping it. They're not stopping it in either case, foot and mouth or mad cow. So, interesting times, I would say, wouldn't you? It's going to be quite a year. And we will keep track of it as best we're able right here. We'll be right back. All right. Let's continue to look at what's going on. I'll tell you, I looked earlier today. I looked at sort of the compilation of everything that's going on right now. And I said, oh, my God. It really has begun. You know, the quickening is well underway in just about every category you can think of. I can't even contemplate not having beef in this country. Now, I know they do have some beef in England. I don't know how many people are eating it. But to have our beef ruined, and at that by our own hand, I guess. Linda Moulton Howe is going to have a report on all of this. At the top of the next hour, she's going to be our guest. Oh, and here, this is really cute. Listen to this. Dear Art, you received an email last week from a person who told you why you went off the air temporarily. This person boasted about a friend who supposedly works for the NSA. Well, you and I both know that someone who works for a three-letter agency will not boast about, quote, we slapped his hand and knocked his butt off the air, end quote. That's nonsense. We know that your comm lines are tapped, but no agent nor employee would spill it like you said his friend did. I've worked for, I have worked for the three-letter agency for 23 years, and I can tell you there is no Team AB. NSA, NSC, nor CIA do not use terms as such. We use code words that do not associate with the subject in question for obvious reasons. On March 12th, the satellite feed was disrupted due to a, get this, folks, satellite-linked comm disruption in Area 51, which I cannot discuss further. But only to say it was an exciting moment in the context of contact. It was so powerful, it affected Air Force Space Command communications out of Vandenberg. This could be the truth, too, folks. I don't know. I really don't know. All right. Do you remember my telling you about one of the most famous, well-chronicled ghost sites in America? The one down in San Antonio, Texas, where just over now, 20 years ago, a busload of children were killed by a train. And since then, it is said, and it has been documented, they push, that is the dead children, push stalled cars over the tracks to safety. In fact, I watched a special on public television about 10 years ago on this. Yeah, it's been on TV a lot. Then the same program did an update on it approximately 10 years later. Each time they used the same test. This test was comprised of sprinkling baby powder on the back of the vehicle placed near the tracks with the car in neutral. After the car had been moved off the tracks to safety, there were many little fingerprints and handprints showing on the back of the vehicle. In other words, folks, these poor children who were killed would push any vehicle put there and left in neutral off the train tracks. Moreover, these dead children would leave fingerprints on the back of the car. This is pretty well documented. Now, I had an email earlier today. A fellow gave me his website, or a website, and they've got a photograph of this crossing, this railroad crossing. It's not a large photograph, but it's easily visible. And if, let me go to it right now. You'll find it under What's New. Then you go to the links page, go down to like the second paragraph of links. I want to think of it that way, and you'll see the haunted railroad crossing. You click on that, it takes you to the website in question, and you scroll down a little bit, and you will see the railroad crossing, and you will see a picture of a young girl, a very young girl, in the middle of the road. Urban legend, maybe. A ghost that we're seeing? Maybe. But it's at that very site that we've talked about so frequently down in San Antonio. So, I've got a lot more here. I don't know that I want to read a lot more. It gets worse and worse and worse. Oh, by the way, we've got a near-Earth asteroid that's going to pass within 0.05 AUs, those would be astronomical units, a 0.05 AU of Earth. Now, in the astronomy world, this is considered to be a near miss. I mean, that's very close, 0.05 AU. The trajectory mentioned is about the distance of four Earth-Moon distances. So it's good to know they're watching these things. You know, it'll be the one that we don't see, of course, that gets us. And there will be a lot, there are a lot of them, unfortunately, they don't see. Remember we were talking the other day about, who was that with? That we needed, that was with Seth Shostak. And he reminded us all, you may recall, that the dinosaurs were killed off by a big rock, allowing the eventuality of human beings, you know, a higher life form. Tragedy turns into something really good for Earth, for us, certainly. And he said, well, if it hadn't been for the rock, we wouldn't be here. How many of you think we need or will get more rocks? Maybe the next jump in evolution occurs after we jump, you know, about a mile high. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning, Art.
Oh, this is a terrible cell phone call.
Oh, yeah, well, you know how that is.
It's just not acceptable.
Oh, hell's bells, Art. How you doing?
You have something very quickly. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, a few things I have to say. That it's in San Antonio, Texas, that you're referring to about,
yes,
about the kids.
Yes.
And I'm a parapsychologist. Well, I'm a parapsychologist and I'm psychic, and I do a lot of things like that. And I've got other pictures that I've had that I went there myself, and you can actually see the fingers.
Oh, yes.
The fingerprints.
Yes.
But the fingers.
Yes. I know.
You can see the whole child itself.
I'm very well aware. In fact, if you will look, thank you very much for that horrible cell phone call. Yes, indeed, you're right. I mean, that's what I just said. If you'll go look at that photograph, you will see the form of the little girl. And you were saying, well, entire forms. Well, here you're seeing an entire form. The pixel people will, as always, pick it apart, but that's all right. And so we got that link up. Keith got that link up a little earlier today. Really excellent. Hey, we got something kind of neat coming up at the bottom of the hour. Kind of unusual. The radio station that is picking us up in Guam began by picking up 1 hour of the show. And before you knew it, boom, suddenly they're picking up the entire program. The audience loved it, so that now they're picking up the entire program. The thing about this program is, when we're on the air now, it's like in the afternoon, 4 or 5 o'clock, something like that, on Guam, on a different day. So what they do is they run us a delay broadcast and put us where this show ought to be, you know, between midnight and 5 or whatever. But the radio station in Guam called today and said that they're going to run a couple half hours live on Guam. And they're going to do that in this next half hour and then the half hour following that. In other words, the next hour basically is going to be live in Guam way in the afternoon, sort of to introduce the audience to it. So we're going to be talking live to Guam here in a few minutes. That's really cool. But they should be running the program at night, not during the day. Much as I would like to be live in Guam, this program belongs on at night. This is a nighttime program. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Oh, cool. Hello. I'd like to speak to Art.
You are, sir. Turn your radio off, please.
Oh, this is Art.
Yes.
Hey, cool. This is Riding Hood down in Florida, man.
Riding Hood?
Riding Hood.
Oh, Riding Hood.
Yes, sir.
Very good, yes.
And I'm curious why they dropped the power band on the AM range when most Americans are home in the evening at that prime time.
They don't necessarily, some stations are drop power, but other stations, they do that so that other stations that are designed to be really long range stations will be long range.
But I noticed like all the South American stations boost their power band range.
Oh, I know. That's because they don't have the equivalent of the FCC that cares. Yeah. I mean, they have something, but they just don't care. I used to work at a station in Mexico, and I can tell you the amount of power they ran on any given day depended on how the engineer wanted to tune up the transmitter that afternoon. That's
cool.
The truth. Cool indeed. We've got to run. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Falling in love was the last thing I had on my mind. Never find just trying to
be so embodied. I want her all for myself. take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 775-727-1222 or call the wild card line at 775-727-1295. To talk with Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Certainly is. Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here. As I told you, we're doing kind of an experiment right now, which I think is ever so cool. We are on the air, if everything worked out right now, live on the island of Guam. Now, you've got to remember, Guam is, you know, like way out there across the international dateline, so it's a different day, and it's like sometime or another in the afternoon on Guam. But they thought they would do this to introduce the audience on Guam to what happens in the overnight hours, which is really where this program belongs. So therefore, we now might have Guam out there right now. Now, if we do, I want to see if I can get some phone calls. No guarantee on this. We have an international line. So if you're on Guam, give it a try. You can call us at the following number. 800-893-0903. Now, I think you've got to get the AT&T operator to accomplish this. I'm not sure. Oh, incidentally, we have on our international line on the website right now, we've got all the new ways to connect. I'll tell you more about that later. I'm mostly concerned about Guam right now. It's News Talk K57 on the island of Guam, affectionately known as the Rock. Be kind of fun to hear a little bit about Guam, wouldn't it? What it's like to be on Guam. I was on Okinawa, but I'll tell you, compared to Guam, Okinawa is a vast area, gigantic geographic area compared to Guam. It's pretty small. Anyway, it'd be fun. So if anybody on Z Island can call in, give it a try. I'm not sure how you have to finagle it, probably AT&T, and call 800-893-0903. If that doesn't work, you'll probably never get through on the other lines. They're all totally jammed up. All right, so here's what we've been talking about. Things don't seem too good tonight. Foot and mouth disease is moving across Europe like wildfire. It's now, as of tonight, in the Netherlands. They're killing thousands of animals and they're not controlling it. Mad cow disease may be in Vermont. They've seized a lot of sheep. They're going to test them. But we've got to face facts. I mean, it could be in Vermont. Markets worldwide appear to be crashing. A slow kind of an everyday 100-point, 200-point, 300-point crash. That's trouble. Worldwide, not just here in America, but worldwide, big time in Japan. California is having rolling blackouts. New York, according to the president, may be next, New York City, for rolling blackouts. Shortages in every category of energy. The weather is turning on us very bad. A mirror is about to splash down God knows where. It's just kind of a not a good night when you think about all the news coming out right now. I wish I could be talking about something lighter. But, I mean, this is the reality. All right, so anyway, somebody in Guam, give that a shot, see if you can get through. Hasn't rung yet, so I have a feeling you're not going to be able to get through or you'd be through already. Then you'd have to think about, well, Guam could always try to get through on the east of the or the west of the Rockies line, but there are millions of people trying to get through on those lines, so I don't think you're going to make it. Guam has a U.S. area code. Can you believe that? They've got a U.S. area code. So, actually, somebody could dial direct from Guam, couldn't they? Why don't I try that? assuming that nobody can get through on the 800 line, why don't I give out the first-time caller line and restrict it to Guam for the next hour? Oh, please, would everybody out there cooperate and not dial the first-time caller line? Could I impose on you all to do that? I'm going to try. Would everybody calling the first-time caller line hang up, please? And we'll see if somebody doesn't mind calling in from... I'll tell you what, I'll take a collect call from Guam. Yes, sir, sir. You get through on the first-time caller line, and I will accept a collect call from Guam. You see, I spend the company's money freely. It's area code 775-727-1222. I'll give you that number again. Area code 775-727-1222. Of course, collect. No problem. You can get through. In the meantime, wildcard line, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello, Art. This is Victor from Amsterdam.
Hello. From Amsterdam.
Amsterdam, Netherlands.
You're in the Netherlands?
I'm listening on the internet.
Welcome to the program.
How are you? I'd like to say hi to my grandma in Oceanside.
Okay.
Hi, Grandma.
Hello, Grandma. All right, if you wouldn't mind, tell us what's going on over there.
Well, the animal situation is, I think, a little overblown in the media. Yeah, I guess they've only found one animal here.
One?
One infected animal.
Yeah, well, that is true, but that's all it seems to take. In other words, when they find one, I think the scientific assumption is there probably are many more.
Yeah, it's. I have no idea what's going to happen. The price of beef is down here.
I bet it is.
Price of chicken is up.
Scared to death. The price of chicken went up.
Way double what it used to be.
No, I hadn't thought of that. Of course it would go up, wouldn't it?
I did have one comment about last night's show with Seth.
Yes?
One thing I don't think you mentioned about why...
Actually, that was the night before, unless you had pee-pees.
One thing that wasn't mentioned was... The reason we can never get radio signals is because the aliens have ESP. Why would they use radio?
Actually, believe it or not, and I thank you for the call all the way from the Netherlands, your point is well taken. Very well taken. It's entirely possible that another race of beings would evolve biologically, if they're biological creatures and not machines of some sort, in a completely different way, in a different atmosphere, with different gravity, with different DNA, if they even have DNA as we understand it. So what you just said sounds wild, but not that wild when you sit down and think about it for a minute. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is Dave in Detroit, and I'd like to speak to Art.
You are. Extinguish your radio, please.
Okay. Hello. How are you doing, Art?
I'm okay, sir.
And I wanted to get with you on the Nellis Air Force Range.
What about it? It's over the hill. Nellis, yes.
Over the hill.
Yeah, from me, it's just over the hill. What about it?
Okay, well, I have the cafeteria phone number. Want to have some fun?
Call the cafeteria at Nellis?
That's right.
Why?
Well, ask them what kind of activity they got today.
Why would I care? Why would any of us care? I mean, you mean what they're serving?
Yeah.
Why would anybody care?
I don't know. I got on a NORAD site, and I ended up at Nellis Air Force Range somehow.
Oh,
and then somehow I ended up with a whole list of personal phone numbers at Nellis Air Force Range.
I know what you are. You're a hacker. You're a hacker, aren't you?
Thought you might like to have some fun with something like that. So.
You've hacked into Nellis Air Force Base?
Well, I got it.
And you've got personal phone numbers?
Yeah, I did. I could have went further, but I didn't.
You could have gone for secret information and you went for phone numbers in the cafeteria?
Well, I'm only looking to have fun.
What kind of hacker are you anyway?
Anyway, I thought that would be, you know, the ultimate place to go, so I ended up there. And
you know where else you might end up?
No, I wouldn't go that far.
Hold them on the line for how long? Okay, go ahead, sir. Whatever else do you have?
I noticed that they're pretty good at cutting you off at certain times on the radio. You were on the other night, and you came up with the liquid antenna?
Oh, the liquid antenna, yes.
Right, and suddenly, there was nothing but blank space for quite a while there.
Oh, really?
That's right, and I'm east of the Rockies, Detroit area.
Well, it must have been your station, because as far as I know, we had no disruption here.
Really? And it was just right after you mentioned it as well.
What station do you listen to back there?
CKLW in Windsor.
Yeah, the big one, that's right, CKLW, all right, fine. Well, for all I know, you probably hacked in and turned their transmitter off. All right, sir, you're out of here. Before they nail you, you know they have these lines traced, tapped, traced. Let's see, on the first time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
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 How you doing, Art?
I'm okay, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Huntington, West Virginia.
Huntington, West Virginia. All right. I was sort of trying to reserve this line for Guam, but...
Well, heck, I can get off here and let you talk to one of those.
No, I mean, go ahead and give me something.
Well, I was a little curious about this hoof and mouth disease you were talking about.
Yes.
I have no idea what that is.
Well, it's real bad news for animals. For humans, it's not a worry, but all the animals that come in contact with it are being killed.
Really?
Many, 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 many animals. And it's spreading across Europe now.
And we're just waiting for something like that to happen here?
Well, here we've got our own little worries right now. Foot and mouth, no doubt, will make its appearance in the appropriate moment. But mad cow disease, which is really, really, really serious, might be in Vermont. You know, they've confiscated all these sheep. They're going to test them. They're going to kill them. But if it's here, we've got a real problem.
That seems pretty nasty.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad there's somebody out there to tell us about it, and then we haven't had any of Art Bell around here.
And I'm sure you just love hearing about it. What great shape we're in. You know, you think about this. Just a few months ago, the market was riding high. We didn't have a care in the world. We had a giant surplus, and we're all fighting about what to do with the excess money. I mean, everything was hunky-dory, just spiffy in the U.S., and now... we have disaster coming from every corner. Interesting year so far, I'd say.
So far, yeah. I just can't wait to see what happens.
All right, I got a number I've got to try here in a minute. Thanks for the call. All right, this is absolutely excellent. We actually have somebody from the island of Guam. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. It's a beautiful afternoon. We've got partly cloudy skies, but beautiful blue behind it. And it's clear to see the ocean.
Is it?
And temperature is, what, about 84, 85 degrees?
Can you see the ocean from anywhere in Guam?
No, not from anywhere. Some of the valleys or some of the roads that go in between the hills, you can't actually see the ocean. But actually, our family lives on one of the higher hills, and we have an ocean view from the front
beautiful.
Of our house.
Yeah.
And if we climb to the top of the hill that's right behind us, we could see both sides of the island and see two oceans.
Well, what actual time is it there now? Do you know?
It is 4:50 on Thursday afternoon.
Time travel.
I know, it's weird. When we talk to our relatives stateside, we always have to look up at the clock and count ahead or backwards and figure out what time they're at. We've gotten quite a few calls from them at 3 or 4 in the morning, and they didn't realize what the time change was.
Well, listen, I lived on the island of Okinawa for a little better than 10 years, so I know what it's like to live on an island.
Mm-hmm.
But not an island as small as Guam. How many people are on Guam?
About 150,000. A lot of them are military. There's both an Air Force base on the north point and the big Navy base on the kind of mid to southern side of the island.
Well, I've got a question for you. How long have you been there now?
2.5 years. My husband's in the Navy.
All right. Well, here's something kind of interesting. When you hear a night like tonight, when I come on and I talk about foot and mouth disease raging across the Netherlands, mad cow disease, maybe back here in the States, we'll know when they test these sheep, the markets, the stock markets crashing worldwide, it seems like, blackouts in California, and blackouts probably in New York City they're now talking about, the weird weather we've got back here, all of this stuff going on. When you hear about all of this, what do you think back on Guam?
Well, we miss parts of it. We don't miss the snow. We rubbed it in the relatives' years when they were under feet of snow and we were going to the beach every weekend.
Mm.
There are problems all over. You're going to have difficulties with problems in advanced planning. We own a home in San Diego that eventually we'll get back to, and right now we're kind of glad we're not there with the rolling blackouts. It's unfortunate that people have to have such a dire situation that they have to deal with, especially if nobody was expecting it.
I take it the power on Guam is solid.
Oh, no.
No. Wasn't on Okinawa
most
either.
Most of the infrastructure here was put together right after World War II, much of it by the military. And so you get some of the same problems that you'll see stateside with the age of the materials that
power
you got.
Stuff, yes. Well,
yeah.
In that case, when you get back to the States, you're going to be comfortable.
Yes, in fact, a few people who have relatives who have just left for stateside say it's just like home because there are problems, wherever you go. But the island is absolutely beautiful. Our tour was originally for 2 years, and we enjoyed it so much that we extended, which quite a few people do. It's one of the highest extension rates in the Navy for people who are here and decide they want to stay an extra year or two and prolong their stay. The island, the native people are hospitable. They go out of their way to do whatever they can for you. There are church-related village fiestas for the patron saints just about every weekend that they always invite everyone to. And we've had a wonderful time here. We really have.
Well, I want to tell you something. You're obviously on a cellular phone, and I must tell
you.
Yeah,
I am.
And I must tell you, your cellular phone sounds better than the cell phones I hear stateside. It's embarrassing.
I was really surprised how quickly I got through. The technology kind of amazes me sometimes. But, we're happy with the service we've had with that, too.
Well, you got lucky, because I went through about 20 phone calls during the break looking for Guam and finally got Guam just about when the break was over.
I'm very glad that I got through. I'm really happy to be talking to you.
Well, you are my virgin caller from Guam.
Okay.
By the way, do you know why they threw virgins in volcanoes?
It was supposed to be to appease the gods.
No, actually to discourage the rest of them from the practice.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Well, listen, thank you. What is your first name?
My first name's Annie.
Annie.
Yeah.
Well, Annie, thank your husband, who was on the phone first, for putting you on.
Yeah, I'm taking him to another location right now, so he was handling the dialing. We had to call about 30 times or something like that to get through. Finally, it was always busy.
Have you heard, by the way, that we're on at night on News Talk K57?
Yes, and if I'm up with the baby, then I'll be sure to tune you in as opposed to turning on the cable. So it'll be interesting to listen.
I get a lot of mothers up with babies in the middle of the night, believe me.
All right. I can imagine.
Well, listen, thank you very much for the call.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. All right, Guam. We actually did it. All right, well, then obviously they can't make it through on the 800 line. I had a feeling, and she even paid for her own call there, too. I had a feeling that perhaps that wasn't going to work. The phone company, of course, said, it'll work. Don't worry. They can call on the international line. Wrong. Way wrong. I knew that you wouldn't be able to, but now I do know that you're out there, Guam, so check us out at night. We do, News Talk K57 runs it, delayed broadcast at night. This program, because of the nature of the material, belongs at night. Nighttime is a far better time to do this kind of material because, frankly, people have more time to contemplate the esoteric than they would during the day. During the day, you're busy. Telephones are ringing. Red phones are ringing. All kinds of things are happening in the military, as a matter of fact, and most of you are pretty busy. But there's also one other advantage on Guam, and that is that a lot of people are in the military, and being in the military, a lot of them are on the third shift. So if you're new to the program, welcome. If you're a third shift worker, what are you doing awake now? Anyway, excellent. I feel so much better now we've got Guam. Coming up in a moment, Linda Moulton Howe. All right.
Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wild card line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Networks.
Top of the morning, everybody. Great to be here. And we got a call from Guam. K57, News Talk K57 on the island of Guam. That was cool. Talk about cool. I was using that expression earlier, my little hacker. That was cool. Out across the dateline. Virtually time travel, as far as I'm concerned. Coming up in a moment, we're going to talk about the most worrisome story in the news tonight by a long shot, and that's mad cow maybe in Vermont there. Maybe it's not even a maybe. I just talked to Linda, and the news is not necessarily so good. But then again, it may not be so bad either, so we'll get to all of that in a moment. Linda Moulton Howe, who's a researcher, crop circles, animal mutilations, that sort of thing. Before that, she was absolutely an award-winning environmental documentary producer. She's just really something else. She's, of course, an author. She has a brand new book out called Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. And we're going to be talking about all of that coming up momentarily. Okay, I was bemoaning the general state of things tonight. It's not too good. Foot-and-mouth disease now in the Netherlands, raging across Europe. Mad cow disease maybe in Vermont. A bunch of sheep were confiscated today after quarantine. The markets worldwide seem to be crashing in slow motion. You know, 100 points, 200 points, 300 points a day. Despite the Fed's action of, 50 basis points, still the market goes down. All the markets. Tokyo at this hour, way down. Power trouble, rolling blackouts in California. President Bush now saying New York City may be next for the blackouts. Mir about to splash down. The only good news is Mir might hit that Taco Bell thing in the ocean and we'll all get a free taco. That's about the only good news. The weather is deteriorating all over the place. And here to try and comment on some of all of this is Linda Moulton Howe, again, who has a brand new book entitled Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. Again, she's a reporter. She's been a reporter for this program for years, a scientific reporter. She's done award-winning environmental documentaries. She's done all kinds of research on crop circles, animal mutilations. She is Linda Moulton Howe from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Here she is. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Art. Well, you know, after months of legal battles, the U.S. Department of Agriculture finally did act today and took 233 sheep from Vermont farmers Houghton Freeman and Linda and Larry Falassi. It started back in July of 2000 when four sheep on their Greensboro, Vermont farm tested positive for antibodies to what is called transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, abbreviated TSE, and it's a family of diseases, and it's caused by misshapen proteins called prions.
Right.
The most famous is BSE, which is bovine spongiform encephalopathy, or mad cow disease. The destructive proteins attack the spinal cord and the brain, and they literally eat holes in tissue, which deteriorate to resemble a sponge. That's why they say spongiform.
And so when it gets to human beings, it's kind of like Alzheimer's, only fast?
It's very fast, and there is no escape from death, whether you're an animal or a human.
Mm.
The BSE form of prions cause fatal mad cow symptoms in both European cattle and humans, which is what has been such a great medical health concern.
Mm-hmm.
And a different prion attacks deer and elk in the American chronic wasting disease. A third kind of prion causes scrapie in sheep, and other different prions are responsible for the fatal Creutzfeldt-Jakob, disease that was first discovered in Germany in 1920, and Kuru diseases in humans that were found in an island in the early part of the century,
right,
where they ate the brains of the dead.
Oh, God. Linda, let me slow you down just for 1 second. Four of these, I didn't know that, four have tested positive, not necessarily for the particular European brand.
Right.
In other words, they don't know that yet, and that's what the testing will tell us, right?
Yes, and there's a surprise about that in terms of what they can learn and how fast. And you will hear this from the veterinarian who is involved in all of this. And I'll give just a little bit more background before we get to her. Since the 1996 epidemic of mad cow cases in England, all kinds of bans were placed on British meat products and animals.
Mm.
But that same year, these Vermont farmers had the idea to import the sheep from Belgium because they are such great milk producers, both in Belgium and Holland, because they wanted to produce gourmet cheeses in the United States, in Vermont, using the goat's milk. Well, by 1998, USDA had quarantined this flock from Belgium and Holland after all the mad cow cases in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
The USDA was worried that the imported sheep, any imported animal, might have eaten feed in Europe contaminated by mad cow disease, which we now know that they were grinding up brains, spinal cords, and everything, and it was going into the feed of the cattle, which in many ways is like exactly what they found in the islands where the island people ate the brains of their dead. Either way, the animals ended up consuming other animals' brains and spinal cords. Well, last July, four of these Vermont sheep that were imported from Holland and Belgium did test positive for antibodies to some kind of transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. No one knows if it is BSE mad cow, scrapie, chronic wasting disease, or what, and that's why the USDA issued, quote, a declaration of extraordinary emergency, unquote,
mm-hmm,
to destroy the sheep. But the owners went to court and contested until today. And this afternoon at a press conference in Montpelier, USDA senior staff veterinarian Linda Detweiler of the Animal and Plant Inspection Service told reporters that the federal district court had ruled in favor of the USDA and ordered the owners to comply. The farmers will be compensated for the fair market value of their sheep. Today, the USDA entered the Greensboro farm and started trucking all 233 sheep to the National Veterinary Services Laboratories in Ames, Iowa.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Linda, why would, just out of curiosity, why would this farmer or these farmers object to all of this if they were going to be paid fair market value for the animals? I mean, in view of how serious this is, why would they object to it?
Yeah, this is something that the reporter that I also am going to do an excerpt from said that he's been talking with these farmers for ever since they contested USDA last summer.
Yes.
And they felt that they, as Americans, quote, had the right to keep their animals, even if they were in quarantine, because they were not convinced that there was enough evidence that they had real sickness. And when you get into the whole a very difficult area of when is an animal weak, when is an animal sick with a flu, when is an animal suffering wasting disease, when does an animal have BSE or something else? And this is where the farmers felt that the government of the United States had, quote unquote, no business coming onto their land and telling them that these expensive animals that they'd imported, that the government would kill on the basis of, remember, it was positive tests for antibodies,
mm-hmm,
not necessarily full-blown sickness of any kind.
Mm.
And we're running into the same exact issue, Art, in Europe, where some of the farmers in England are so upset, so distraught,
I know.
That that they want to fight anybody who comes on their land because they're saying that their animals are healthy.
They may kill, what, a million animals in Europe, is that right?
Yes, it's horrible to try to control hoof and mouth disease, which for anybody listening who might be confused, hoof and mouth is a virus, like the way people will get flus and colds. Hoof and mouth is a very contagious virus. When we're talking about the BSE mad cow, it's a completely different organism. It is a protein. It is a protein that exists in every mammal, from humans to cows and other mammals.
All right, let's forget the foot and mouth. We'll get back to that shortly. It's really important. But
they're very different, but they're causing a lot of death. And now these sheep that were picked up today are going to be killed over a period of several days, and their brain and spinal cords will be examined for this spongy tissue found in prion diseases.
Right.
But I was surprised to learn from the veterinarian that it will take 2 to 3 years before medical researchers know which kind of prion disease the Vermont sheep have, and you'll hear a little bit why.
Because I got to talk. 2 to 3 years, Linda?
2 to 3 years. This is the first time that I learned this, and the reporter I talked to this afternoon has been on this story for 2 years. It was the first time he realized it.
I was expecting a follow-up tomorrow.
Yes, it doesn't work that way, and you're going to hear a little bit about this from Dr. Linda Detweiler. She was able to talk with me briefly after the press conference this afternoon.
And again, she is?
She is the senior staff veterinarian on Animal and Plant Inspection Service for the USDA. She led the press conference this afternoon. She is the one who spoke to the media, and she talked to me afterwards on a phone that broke up now and again, and you'll hear that, but you'll get the main idea from her, and this is now USDA veterinarian Linda Detweiler.
All right.
Based on the findings and all the information we provided, the science and the test results, the court supported the decision by the USDA to remove the sheep. The samples will be taken for diagnostic testing, and then the carcasses will be safely disposed. The brain material of ones that test positive on the other test would be injected into these 5 different panels of mice, and then we would wait about 2 to 3 years for the mice to come down with the disease.
Huh.
And then there's this kind of a scheme or procedure how they characterize the disease in the mice to find what strain it is.
But right now in March of 2001, with these animals that have gone to Ames, Iowa today, will they be able to identify the prion in the brains of the animals that they kill?
Well, they're going to do the diagnostic test that's available to everybody in the world that would give you if they have a TSC or not.
But what you're saying is that we wouldn't know for 2 or 3 more years if it were actually the same prion that has been responsible for the BSE syndrome in Europe?
Yes, correct.
Does that apply for the scrapie prion?
It does, ma'am. It does apply for all the agents that are caused by or in the family TSC.
Now, from a veterinarian's perspective, what have been the symptoms, if any, in these 4 sheep that had the positive antibodies?
Well, it's been kind of vague in the flock that we've just had kind of wasting conditions, which you can see with the TSCs.
So you have had a wasting condition in the
flock.
Yes. A Vermont newspaper reporter who has been covering this story since 1999 is John Dillon with the Rutland Herald and Argus Times in Montpelier. He was at the press conference and said Dr. Detweiler expressed USDA concern that the farmers had allowed the quarantine sheep to breed.
And then the second thing she said was that the Falaises animals have bred and have produced 27 more sheep, which alarmed the USDA because they've hoped that they wouldn't have more sheep to kill and that they're concerned about the potential spread off the farm if the animals keep breeding. So they thought it was time to move. And she also said that other farmers in Vermont and around the country were pressing the USDA to just do something, get rid of it.
Meaning because these sheep were there as a big question mark
right.
of possibly having this strange prion disease that no one knows exactly how it spreads or what it could do.
Right. Yeah. There are other dairy sheep farmers in Vermont whose milk sales and cheese sales have suffered because when people go to the supermarket, they just think Vermont sheep cheese, and they say, "Ew, I've heard about that. I don't want to buy that." So they want these sheep gone. The people who make goat milk cheese want these sheep gone. The entire U.S. Vermont congressional delegation want these sheep gone because they don't want a black eye on Vermont agriculture. The Palaces and the Freemans have their supporters, but there are also many people who say, these are just sheep, and this is too serious a disease.
I'm one of those people, and you're telling me that this farmer wouldn't give him up, fought the legal fight just because of some principle with regard to why the government can't do this, something
well,
like that?
Well, they were crying, apparently, today, both of the two different families, because they had spent a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of effort on developing this gourmet cheese business, and they felt that the positives in the antibodies in the sheep didn't warrant killing 233. In other words, it's the same exact argument that is going on in Europe now. If you have one sick animal or five, why do you slaughter 300 or whatever? And that is the problem, and I don't think, Art, that is going to end. I think that there is an increasing huge problem because farmers in England are faced with bankruptcy, are declaring bankruptcy, and the USDA and the U.S. government are doing everything they can, obviously, to prevent anything happening here.
I would like to thank them personally for that.
Yeah, but the tension, and you can put yourself in the shoes of these people, that they had four sheep that were culled.
Linda, you know, I really can't. I'll tell you honestly, if I was in that position and I was a farmer and I understood that I could, in effect, be patient zero, even if there was a bit of a chance for it, I would absolutely opt with the government. Hey, look, I'm not a government fan by any means, Linda, but one thing that our government does do is look after the general health and welfare of the citizens, you know, in a general way. And this really is in that category.
And it's very clear, Art, that prions really are truly a mystery. I have been talking with researchers on the West Coast and the East Coast and in the Midwest who are trying to track for the CDC any cases that fall into the prion category. They are on the lookout for anything that might be a match to the shape of the prion in Europe that is the BSE prion shape.
Yep.
As far as I know, talking with medical people, the BSE protein has not shown up in humans or animals in the United States. If these sheep from Vermont in 2 to 3 years, if they turn out to have BSE, they will be the first animals in the world outside of England and Europe, and they are at this point, I think that's why they're holding the door open, that it could be scrapie and it could be some strange cross species transfer of that chronic wasting disease, which is prion. It does affect animals in North America.
Linda, I'm told
that spread.
I'm told these prions, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you burn the carcass of an animal, burn it, you don't destroy the prions.
Just burning does not destroy them. It has to be under pressure and heat, like an autoclave. They have found, I talked with a CDC researcher on the destruction of prions, and they have found that if they put instruments or anything that has prion contamination in an autoclave, which is pressure and heat with bleach, it has to be some kind of a strong bleach for 4 to 6 hours, they feel like they can then kill the prion.
It takes that much to kill the prion.
Yeah.
So then these farmers in Europe that have burned carcasses are doing nothing but putting prions in the air?
Nobody knows, really. It is a strange question. I've seen those issues on the Internet. I don't know anybody medically who would say that, because I think right now...
Belinda, you're going to have to...
But Art, just to close this out, I think that the current medical thinking is that you have to, an animal or a human has to ingest the prions in contaminated tissue, which is largely the spinal cord and the brain.
That's what they think. All right, hold on, Linda. Oh, wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I'm Art Bell.
Dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. Or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the Premier Radio Network.
All right, so that's the latest on the mad cow scare. In a moment, we'll have a conversation with Linda that I had just before we got on the air, and we didn't really have enough time to do it. We have the luxury of time on talk radio tonight. We'll have that conversation about why they're slaughtering up to a million animals in Europe because of hooven mouth. Linda really had a really interesting comment. We'll get to it in a moment. So you see, you just learned something very valuable. The test results from these animals will not be in for 2 years. Holy mackerel, 2 years. That's how it spread in Europe. Well, it was going on for a long time and they didn't know about it. God, incredible. Again, I say, you know, just a few months ago here in America, everything was ducky. The markets were soaring. People's net worth was soaring. Disease was, well, if not being conquered, at least worked hard on. And all of a sudden, just the space of a few months, look how things have gone downhill. Amazing. Once again, here's Linda Moulton. Now, Linda, we were talking before we got on the air about hoof and mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, now I don't know what hoof and mouth is, really, but you said that hoof and mouth to an animal is basically no more serious than flu is to a human.
Yeah, it's compared in a way to flus and colds. It is a virus, which is a very different thing than what we've been talking about in the prion, which is a protein that occurs in mammals. So the interesting thing about this, in some ways, the perspective of kill animals or try to come up with a vaccine, the last big siege of hoof and mouth in the United States was around 1929.
Yes.
And after that, there have been efforts to come up with vaccines for it, just like we have flu vaccines. But everybody knows that every year there is a new flu vaccine trying to deal with the changes in the viruses. The same thing happens in hoof and mouth disease.
Yeah, for the first year, I got a flu shot, Linda, and for the first time in years, I got the flu.
A lot of people have that story, and it may or may not have something to do with a faulty vaccine. It may have to do with the fact that the viruses change so much that to stay up with what the virus shape is with a new vaccine is always a challenge, and we have the same challenge in hoof and mouth disease. And so, over time, the policy of trying to come up with a vaccine to deal with hoof and mouth versus a decision to kill animals to prevent the spread has the scale over time went into kill any animals as soon as you see it.
Why?
To prevent spread.
Why? If it's nothing more serious than the flu and they get over it and get better, then why would anybody want to kill them?
It is a question that many people have discussed, and in fact, some medical people think that in some ways it might be better off for the farm community to bite the bullet on letting whatever a herd or a country, let them go through the disease, get immunity, get a generation of cattle that have more immunity to this, because they don't necessarily, in fact very infrequently, do animals die of hoof and mouth disease. It's that if they do weaken, milk production goes down, there can be effects on calving, all of the things that will happen when any animal is sick, and that's what the rancher and the farmer, they don't want to go through losing that production time and that money, but you might weigh it against
that doesn't make sense. Not killing a million animals. So, me, I guess I'm a little conspiratorial, but I don't think it takes a rocket scientist here to suggest they know something we don't. I mean, a million animals, that's an incredible financial burden. A million animals? I mean, come on. The only reason they'd be doing that, Linda, is because either it's mutated into some form that they really don't like and they're scared to death of, that they haven't told us about, or there are repercussions that go way beyond basically an animal getting the flu and getting better. Yeah, they wouldn't kill a million for that. It doesn't even make sense.
Well, there's the political money side of everything, and that is that you've got countries pressuring countries that don't allow any of this to spread international markets because they don't want to deal with the inconvenience of sick animals. They don't want to lose money. And so there's a tremendous amount of pressure just to kill animals to keep them out of the supply.
Boy, Linda, I don't know.
There's a lot of death. And, you know, funny, it's a kind of a segue, actually, to some of the subject matter and mysterious lights in crop circles. But it is very interesting that over the last decade of people who have gone every year to England or people who live there and in Europe, because the phenomena has gone way beyond England, always has been.
Right.
Last year, people don't realize that the very first formations in the year 2000 began in February in the Spain area and then to Italy.
Now you're talking about crop circles.
Yeah, but right. But I'm leading up to a connection to what we're talking
maybe
about.
Maybe there is a connection. Jeez.
That there's been a global signature in these formations, and they did not begin in England last year. They began in the Mediterranean area and then moved up through Germany and the Czech Republic and Holland, and then there was a parallel. England was starting with Germany, and England always has had lots of formations, but it's not confined there. And the various perspectives of people over the last 10 years who have had any encounters with these strange lights that they associate with the fields where formations have occurred, one of the most interesting and haunting of the stories is this, now he's 19 years old, a Dutch person in Hoven, Holland. And I think a year ago or so, you and I, we had talked about this on a coast. And it's continued to evolve that he is now, I think, four times has seen these lights. Usually they're small, not much larger than grapefruit or a football in diameter. And he has seen plants go down in front of him. Other people have seen the lights around the fields with him. He has touched the soil and the plants and found them hot to touch. And one of the most interesting things in talking with Nancy Talbot, who has been working in collecting the soil and collecting the plants and going to England and trying to deal with the Dutch and the English translation issue, and when you talk with him about what does he think is happening? What did these lights, does he get any communication at all? And here was one of the quotes from her. Robert said the crop formations are very important, somehow connected to what he thinks are angels, and humans should be paying attention to them. It has something to do with problems in the environment and deceit. The crop circles, he says, are like an antidote, but he has no idea what exactly that means or why he is involved. And when you start going into the multiple levels of crop formations over the last 10 or 12 years, you realize that there seems to be a point and a counterpoint to the symbols themselves.
Yes.
That there are areas where they repeat over and over again, almost as if something comes down and then another thing comes down, in what I describe in the book are layers of points and counterpoints. And that one of the associations that you begin to feel the deeper you get into this is that long ago, let's take it back even 20,000 years ago, there have been these influences of what some people call megalithic cultures that have built in gigantic stones, whether they were the huge stones of the circles of Stonehenge or the big stone sculptures on Easter Island or Mesopotamia, Egypt. There has been a period on the earth where things were built on a very large scale. And in the opening of my book, I raise some of the questions that I hope that you and the readers will think about as we start through this journey tonight, and the issues of a very troubled earth and something interacting with crops and with lights that don't fall into any structure category. They are universally described as being like flickering brightnesses. And tonight, in fact, I will share with you one of my own eyewitness experiences in England this past summer with one of these.
You did go to England. You did go to England, didn't you?
Yes.
Spent a lot of time actually investigating all of this.
Yes, and I both 99 and 2000, and I have some very dramatic experiences to describe. But there are some questions that I think that everybody should think about, because on the science side, you have at least one biophysicist who has been writing in journals and papers saying that he thinks that the energy that is creating the formations is a spinning plasma vortex. And what is the trigger that would repeatedly produce them in many different countries around the world, from Australia to Spain to Russia, France, the United States, Canada, and Europe?
But the Linda, I have a question. The biggest concentration of these crop circles has certainly, I think, can fairly be said to be Britain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They started off years ago in Britain, very simply, simple circles. In the beginning, in what was it, the 90s, right? The early 90s.
All the way back into the 70s. The first proliferation of them began around 89.
Okay.
The world really started hearing about them in 90, and
right.
By 91, they were in 23 countries.
But they began simply, right?
Yeah.
All right, and they progressively became more complex, and that still continues today. In the area where they first began, they are far more complex, and now in other areas of the world, like in Canada and here in the U.S., they have begun simply. Now, to me, the layman guy here, I think there's a message.
A teaching
that is underway, and somehow the pupils don't quite have it yet.
Well, and in fact, some of the questions that I posed in the book are these supervised by an advanced intelligence that humans have yet to encounter? And could the lights be connected to the same ancient intelligence that inspired other marks around the world in ziggurats, pyramids, mounds, and stone circles? And I pose that as a question, and on the other side of my question is a growing sense that there is a connection, and the deeper that you get into mysterious lights and crop circles, I think the more profound that begins to resonate with the areas that these have occurred, and that there are intricacies about the symbols themselves are that in some cases, things have come down in fields that aren't even present in current world symbolism. And some people have recognized, for example, there has been a menorah on May 31st, 1999, 2 years ago at Barbary Castle, north of Avebury. There was a Hebrew menorah. It appeared in Barley on May 31st, 1999, and the base of it, which is a beautiful photograph in the book, it has three prongs. And the three prongs is something that may not have jumped out to some people, but it did to a Hebrew attorney here on the East Coast of the United States. He knows me and has followed the work, and he called me up and said, I have seen this photograph of this menorah, and he said, and I am stunned because that particular tripod base has really not been depicted in the Hebraic faith. You'd have to go back into Capernaum, into the synagogues, around the 3rd century A.D. And he sent me some material showing photographs from museums about that depiction of the menorah that goes back so far.
Did he have any idea what it might have meant?
And, well, it's that it's ancient and not under on the radar of the current world.
I understand.
The current world is looks at the round base of the menorah, and he raised the question. He said, quoting from him, he said, the depth and breadth of knowledge that you are showing in the crop formations would be very difficult to find in one individual or even a small group. And then he pointed out the fact that the menorah that came down in 1999 was in the same field where the Kabbalah Tree of Life had been 2 years before on May 3rd, 1997, near Barbary Castle. It's right near the same place. And that there were little differences, little mathematical configurations in that Kabbalistic Tree of Life that puzzled some people. And he raises these questions. Is there someone with knowledge about where the origin of all of these came from, these symbols, that is trying to communicate and can't communicate the way we'd like another intelligence to sit down and talk with us at coffee, that there is something profound that is going on, and that that boy, Robert, in Holland, when he gets a sense of something in the unseen that is concerned about the environment, is concerned about deceit and some kind of an antidote, it provokes me because point and counterpoint sure. come up in these symbols.
Sure. All right, Linda, a very important question for the audience. Some people are going to be hearing this for the first time tonight. A lot of people, because of publicity, in Britain, in Australia, in New Zealand, even here in the U.S., believe that crop circles are rubbish, that humans are creating crop circles, and to be sure, I'm certain some have been created by humans. Could you dispel for us the possibility that all of them have been created by human beings?
My mind is flooded with everything from hard physical evidence in the science to all of the people that I have listened to their encounters, looked at their photographs, their videotapes of these strange lights. The lights I have even heard are described by some of the guys who have gone out into the fields. This past summer, I sat and listened at a table while they told me that when they had tried to go out and make some formations, these are men in England specifically, that they were scared to death when small lights came into the field and seemed to chase them away. And that these very men who have bragged about making a few formations are themselves provoked, scared, fascinated, challenged by what are these lights. And one of the, somebody said, why did you do this book? The first time that I went to England to go into a formation was in 1992, and I was back in 93 and 95 and 99 and 2000. And in that evolution going back to 92, I started gathering some of the off-the-record comments at the time back in 92 of people saying that they had seen lights and, in fact, It was Steve Alexander, the photographer in England, who was the first to videotape one of these for 5 minutes. People forget. These are long duration.
I know. I remember. We've talked about this over the years.
Yes, and Steve's videotape and his description was almost like the summary of everything that was to follow over the years. And he's the one who said it didn't have structure. It had was a flickering brightness, pulsing, flashing, flickering, and shining. And the man on the tractor at the other end of the field, Steve was up on a hill, and he was photographing down as this flickering brightness was moving across this big Stanton St. Bernard field. And there was a man on a tractor at the other end of the field was watching this flickering brightness come toward him. So there were two witnesses to this. Both men at two opposite ends of the field said the same thing, that it reminded them of light shining off of bright silver, but they couldn't see any structure. And yet, in the videotape, one of the very interesting things, and I show this in one of the photographs in Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, this flickering brightness seemed to have no structure to these two men and is on videotape for 5 minutes, is casting a shadow as it moves.
All right, Linda, we've got a break here. I know you're a very skeptical scientist, and it's good that you're skeptical, and I'm going to ask you one more time. Are you certain in your own mind that some of these crop circles, or even a majority of them, are not being done by human beings?
I am convinced that there is a physical interaction with the cereal crops and grasses of this planet that cannot be explained
all right, you'll
by
have to,
humans.
All right, you're all right. That's definitive. We'll be right back.
Inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch or the scent of a sound or the strength of an oak leaves deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. That all these things in our memories of and the user to help.
Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
You know, dare I say this, when you read today's headlines and you listen to the news and you look all around you at everything that's happening, you remember back at the beginning of the year when everybody was worried about Y2K? They spent billions of dollars and it didn't happen. It's kind of like it's happening now. You know, the power blackouts. I'm not even going to go through the markets. All of it, it's like a delayed reaction or something. Only it's not because of Y2K. I don't exactly know what's up right now, but I know something is up. Linda Moulton Howe is here. She's got a brand new book. And you will have one opportunity tonight to get a brand new copy of Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, Linda Moulton Howe's new book, to get an autographed version of it. This will be your basic one-time offer. But I'm not going to tell you right now. Keep listening. It'll come up shortly. We'll get back to Linda Moulton Howe in a moment. Once again, Linda Moulton Howe. Yeah, Linda, you know, it seems a little like Y2K, delayed effect.
Yeah, I think you're... I do. I think it's a great point. It is if everything fell apart that everybody expected a year ago, and it's happening now.
Wow.
And there were all of those purchases and upgradings of computers that sort of reduced the computer demand also for this year. And it may be that 2 years it'll be a completely different story, but it is like a delayed reaction.
Wow. All right, Linda, back to the crop circles. I too, believe that not in a zillion years, considering some of the size of some of the crop circles and the way they were formed and the eyewitnesses and people who saw them in airplanes formed and all the rest of it. I've heard all the stories, and you've been there right in the middle of it all, year after year after year. They're obviously not done by humans. That's my opinion.
Well, and could I have you go to a website story, and there will be images for both you and for listeners that you can begin to see through my eyes, through the photographs and the drawings, because I've posted at my website 2 stories with drawings that underscore exactly what you were asking me before the break. Why is it that people who are there and myself as an investigator, you come to the conclusion that you're dealing with something that is not easily...
All right, are we talking earthfiles.com?
Yeah, go to...
All right, there's a link on my website, folks. All you do is go to program tonight's guest. You'll see Linda's name right there, and you'll also see the link right there to her website, earthfiles.com. Just click on that, as I'm now doing.
And when you get there... Click on Real X-Files.
Here it is. I'm clicking on it as we speak, yes.
And the first story, don't go to the top one, which I'll get to in a second. Go to Mysterious Clouds of Light in English Crop Formation.
All right, clicking on that now. And so are a lot of other people, obviously. But, oh, my God. The first one dispels human participation in my mind right away.
Well, this is such a wonderful and remarkable story because it's multiple eyewitnesses, and the main man who is talking in this story is one of the most honest human beings that any of us have ever met. He is from Bern, Switzerland, Werner Anderhub. He has gone into the field for years. And he was out to see what we called the galaxy, July 23rd, 1994. This amazing formation was discovered, and for anybody who is looking at it, it is one of the more remarkable of the last 10 years.
A lot of people are looking at it. It's absolutely awesome. How big is that?
This went from one side to the other. I believe it was about 200 feet.
About 200 feet.
And this is the amazing part of this story. Here is Werner. It's at night. It's pretty late at night, and he is entering with his friends. He comes into the southeast corner of the field. He's about 150 meters from this formation when a very large and bright light seems to come right from the ground inside of the crop formation, as if it is bounded by the crop formation, and rises into the sky.
As though it came out of the earth, you mean?
Yeah, as if it came right up out of, as he said,
wow,
right up out of the wheat. And they're standing there, not believing what they're seeing. And he says, quote, "The light was so bright, it lit up the hills in the background. It was bluish white in color and about as big as the formation," which he says is 50 to 60 meters. And I said about 200 feet, so that'd be maybe 190 feet, 185 feet. "The bright light formed some sort of cloud, and it changed shape continuously as it hovered over the formation. After a couple of seconds, it rose at slow speed and disappeared into the darkness, and my friends and I were totally flabbergasted. As we stood in the dark night, a second light emerged from the formation, repeating exactly the same action and movement as the first one, and after about a minute, there was a third light, and then a fourth light appeared. And the fourth one did not just form a cloud, it formed a perfect rectangular shape like a shoebox, hovering only a few meters above the wheat and measuring 5 by 20 by 60 meters. It was transparent like a jellyfish, and it didn't just hang there. It started to float toward us. At that point, my friend began to get really scared, and he wanted to run away, but I asked him not to go. And at that instant, the light stopped. It floated back toward the formation, where it transformed into another cloud and moved slowly up into the dark sky. At that point, two other friends arrived, and a fifth light emerged from the formation, forming another bright cloud that hovered for a couple of seconds, after which it moved upward and disappeared into the sky. And he says we had witnessed something we could not explain. And this summer, I talked with Werner about this directly. This was a 1994 experience, and it is so memorable. And he said that as this box-like thing, which is you can see in the drawing at the website, began to move toward them, and that he was fascinated, but his friend was terrified, that he felt that the terror itself is what stopped whatever this box-like light was, that it responded to them, and that in its retreat, he felt it was signaling that it would not approach if there was going to be so much fear.
I'd be terrified of it, too.
Well, this is a remarkable story by a very honest man who had other friends with him, and they all saw this. And then if you come up through time...
May I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't it be fair? You said that these lights came up out of the crops. Why wouldn't it be fair to suggest they came up out of the earth?
It could be. You know, everybody has their own perceptions of things, and unless we're there, it's hard to know, because if light's coming up and you're 150 meters away, who knows whether it's coming from the ground or from the crops.
Yes, but there's an equal possibility. I mean, if that came up out of the crops, well, there's a little bit of, there's some crops there, but then beneath that is the earth. That's what's there. So, a Native American might suggest to you that this is an action of the earth itself.
Well, I completely agree that we're dealing with energies that we do not understand, and we don't understand the origin, and my best word for all of it is from the unseen. Whatever it is originating from, I think it's powerful, I think it's intelligent, I think it reacts, it knows, it seems to know a lot of what's going on in human minds. And there is another story. It is the one above mysterious clouds.
Just one other quick thing before we get into that. Linda, we coexist on this planet with dolphins, right?
Right.
Yeah. I'm told that dolphins, that they measure intelligence by the size of the animal and the size of the brain.
And it's much larger than ours.
Yeah, and the dolphins are way up there. Now, if dolphins are intelligent in a manner that we don't fully understand at all, and they were going to try to communicate something to us, they might not really be able to do that. I mean, they occasionally save a swimmer or something like that, but I mean, if they wanted to communicate with the human race, assuming they have that level of intelligence that we don't understand, they wouldn't be able to do that, Linda, short of in mass swimming up on a beach, and we'd just dismiss that. So I don't know how they would communicate with us.
Unless you get into this area of telepathy, which when we use that word, we're talking about a human getting another human's thought, a human getting an animal's thought, an animal getting a human thought, and anybody, any of us who live with cats know that cats know exactly what's in your mind. They don't need verbal.
Yes.
So the same thing between something in the marine world like the dolphins could be happening, and why they go and rescue children or people out in water.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that there is a telepathic aspect to that, and certainly I know that I have felt standing in formations, there is this sense of a palpable intelligence that is staring at you. Everybody who has ever spent any time in formations has this experience. It is a staring intelligence. It is as if you are being watched and absorbed at the same time. It reminds me of once being in Africa and being very close to a male lion and some lionesses, and they were tracking after some wildebeest. And as I watched them and their eyes that would stare between me and what they were after,
yes.
You don't need words.
Oh, let me tell you, Linda, I've never been inside a crop circle, but I had the same experience in Africa that you did, so I know exactly what you mean.
Yes, and when you're in a crop formation, in some of them, it is so palpable. And there is a friend of mine who has been investigating crop formations for some time. I feature him in the book. His name is Charles Mallett. He's married to Frances Mallett. And he's had some remarkable experiences in formations. And one of them is in that story that I posted tonight, just so people could see the what he drew for me and what Frances drew for me,
mm-hmm.
of a very interesting experience. This is now, we're up to May of 1999. And Frances was up on a hill above the field that everybody has heard of, Milk Hill. And Charles was down in one of the circles, and I'm showing this amazing formation. I think it's one of the most amazing formations because it was in oilseed rape. And it was in the spring, and anybody who has ever been in England and tried to walk through oilseed rape when it's flowering or even later in the season when it becomes dry, I'm telling you, it is difficult. And yet here is this refined, delicate, strange machine-like, I call it the machine for lack of a better term, gears, who knows what it is. And Charles went down into the far right circle that is on that photograph at night just to hang out in the formations, which a lot of people do, to see if they can interact with what they sense is this intelligence that you and I were just talking about. And as he was sitting in there, this is what happens, and we're going to hear it now in his own words.
Oh,
Charles Mallett.
All right.
Sitting inside of this formation, for any of you who are looking at it at earthfiles.com.
Sit there for a couple of hours, up until about midnight 30. I take a look up to Sirius, the brightest star in the sky, and then I look down, and all of a sudden, there's a bright, diffused luminosity, a luminous sphere, about 10, 15 meters in front of me, just above ground level, behind the standing tuft, the standing center in this crop circle, which is about 2 feet across, with wide, thick stalks. So I can see between them, so they're in silhouette. This light is behind them, and next to the back wall of the circle. And I sit there and watch this for about up to a minute, but probably it's hard to tell, 30, 40 seconds. I had my camera next to me. It didn't even occur to me to pick it up. Color-wise, it was white, diffused, with a hint of orange, kind of self-luminous, but not. It wasn't casting a bright light at all. You know, it was kind of glowy, but very localized, you know. But it was very, very objectively there. You know, I had enough time to shift my position, move away from the standing center so I could look around. And, you know, it was there, you know, I'm actually sleeping in these things, you know, hoping for some kind of direct interaction with whatever is doing this stuff, and my mind goes blank, so I don't actually, you know, think of anything apart from watching. And after, up to a minute, 40 seconds, whatever, long enough to be absolutely sure that this, you know, this object is there, it just fades out. I must say, actually, I didn't see it pop in, fade in, or anything like that at all. But its exit was just faded out over about 2 seconds, just and faded out to nothing and just disappeared.
All right, but no great mental message received. As amazing as all that is, it's like whoever's trying to communicate with us, Linda.
Yeah.
Or whatever, is making a serious attempt, but it's just not happening, perhaps any more than the dolphins trying to communicate with us. And yet there's a message here somewhere. How do we find it?
Well, as we work through tonight, we will be talking about a lot of things, but I think right now it's important for people to understand that while Charles was having this amazing experience with this light suddenly appearing so close to him down inside of the oilseed rape, up on the hill, his wife was with a friend. They're looking down on the formation, and you can see at earthfiles.com at this story that she drew showing how they saw three lights come down from the wheat at the top of the hill and move across the formation. They, neither of the group, the women up on the hill did not know what was happening to him down in the formation. He did not know that they were seeing these three lights move low across the very formation that he was sitting in.
Right.
And when you start coming up to what are the dramatic videotapes and the photographs of exactly what people have been trying to describe now for 10 years, very often, as Charles said, so many people, you hear the same thing. I had my camera. It was right beside me, and I didn't even think to lift it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a few people have. And one of those is a man named Andy Buckley from Manchester. And this past summer, I spent a couple of different nights with him and a couple of other people up on Woodboro Hill. And he returned to the hill, coming back all the way from Manchester down to Wiltshire, because he was haunted, literally haunted, by what occurred with him in July of 2000, not very long before I got over there. And he wrote up a report and gave it to me when I was in England, and we spent time in the very area because, as he wrote in his report, he had taken up a videotape camera, he had binoculars, he had a Panasonic, it was a good camera, I saw it, and it was the evening of July 18th. And he was on Pickett Hill looking down across what's called the hidden field with Woodboro in front of him. Most of the time, we're all on Woodboro Hill looking down to the field at Pickett Hill. He was coming in reverse. And he noticed a flash. That was the first thing to his left.
All right, Linda, this is going to be obviously a very dramatic story. Hold it right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Obviously a very dramatic story. Me too. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Kingdom of Nye, from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. And the wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
You know, you've really got to do yourself a favor. Go to tonight's guest, that's Linda Moulton Howe. Click on the link to take you to her website. I'm
I never interrupt that part. It's instructional. Go to Linda's website and take a look at this formation. I'm telling you right now, it's entitled Mysterious Clouds of Light in English Crop Formation. And when you have looked at the formation itself, which is obviously intended to be instructional in some manner, and then go down to the close-up of the same formation and look at the close-up photographs, if you can come away from that and think the hand of man did it, then you need a new monitor or something. Eyeglasses. I mean, it's impossible. Once you've looked at this, you understand that whatever it is we're dealing with here, it definitely is not man. It may or may not be a message for man, but it's not man. There's no question about that. Man didn't do this. You go take a look and you tell me. Absolutely no question about it. That's number one. Number two is Linda's brand new book, the one we're talking about right now, with all the evidence in it, is called Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. Brand new book. You have exactly 24 hours to get a one-time and one-time-only special offer. You can get an personally autographed book, autographed by Linda Moulton Howe, by calling the 800 number that I'm going to give you right now. And I assume that it's working now, so unless we hear otherwise, you can call right now. It's 800-864-7991. You writing that down? You have only 24 hours to do this. After that, the book obviously is going to be available in bookstores nationally. But this is this pre-release special deal, an autographed copy of one of the best investigators in the world of this sort of thing, of a brand new book that will simply stop your heart. Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, autographed by Linda Moulton Howe, 24 hours, then the deal's off. Only chance you've got. The number is 800-864-7991. I think you can call it right now. We'll ask Linda about that in a minute. 800-864-7991. Autographed. Only chance. That's it. You know, when I warn you about these things, I'm telling you the truth. So, it's now or never. I actually collect first edition autographed copies of books, so I expect my autographed copy of this, Linda. Is that number available now? I hope that number is okay now. That's
what the publisher, Paper Chase Press, said. If anybody has any problem, supposed to be operators that stand by on that number.
They're busy right now.
Okay. And that's good.
Yeah, that's good, I guess.
And yes, I want you to have a hand autographed copy from me directly, and I'll make sure you get one.
Thank you. All right, now we're up on the hill.
Yes.
We've got a fellow who's got a video camera in his
He's operating this as well as any amateur videotape I've ever seen. Because what occurs in front of him is so startling that most people become nervous and jittery and everything starts flying around. But he had a tripod, and that is what makes this tape so exceptional. And over a course of 15 minutes, this is a series of events that he estimated took over 15 minutes, of which he has a lot of it on videotape, he saw a flash in the direction of Woodboro Hill. He looks to his left, and he's surprised to see this small, bright object moving along the surface of this plowed field at the foot of the hill. And then he gets the camera on it, and he notices another object appears from the same direction, again traveling over this. There's a crop circle there, a simple one. And these two lights seem to disappear sort of from roughly the same area of the field. Then a third object appears, and I've seen all of this. Art, what I'm telling you, I've seen with my own eyes on his videotape. It's remarkable. And these are small, glowing, bright, flickering brightnesses of some sort. And this third comes, and then he hears this sound, and to his, he had almost scared him. He couldn't believe it, that over the crest of Woodboro Hill, which is right in front of him, comes this huge military helicopter. And it comes, there's trees up there on top of Woodboro, and the helicopter comes from behind the trees on the summit of Woodboro, and it drops down over into the field where these lights have been appearing. And for what he estimated was 7 minutes, the helicopter circled, and you see it. You see it as if it is looking for the lights. It appears to be directly focused on the area where you've seen these lights.
Sounds like a British version of Apocalypse Now.
Jeez. It's amazing. And then you see the helicopter as if it finally decides to move off, and it starts going. And he said that it was so astonishing that I was just about ready to close up my my camera when here come two more objects again through the left of Woodboro Hill.
All of this on videotape.
All on this is on videotape. It's the most amazing videotape, and I'll tell you something about it here in a second. And now you're watching these two lights, and he doesn't know which one to focus on. And he can't keep them both in the same frame. He's as tight in as he can go and still keep everything smooth.
Right.
So he tracks on one. Remember, there were two. Now he's tracking on one, and you see it split in two. I had them re-rack that tape. I've looked at hundreds of videotapes in my career. You in 1/30th of a second, because you've got videotape running at 30 frames a second.
That's
in
right.
One frame, you see the light go from one to two. The darndest thing I've ever seen. And you see this occur also when you're running it at a normal speed. He doesn't know what happened. I don't know what happened, except that it seems as if these lights were demonstrating something, knowing that this man, maybe, back to the animal-human communication or intelligence, that it knew that he's as a videotape on a tripod. Who knows? Because you get all of this on the videotape. Now, I've seen the tape, and I've talked with Andy Buckley, is his name, about getting the videotape into the United States to show everyone.
Yes. Well,
and
that's where I was going to go if you didn't. Where is the tape? What's going to happen?
Yes. In the summer, he said, yes, I will make you a copy. I'll get it on NTSC. By the fall, when I got back, he said that he had been approached by somebody in the military not to give the tape out.
Oh, brother.
I have talked with him many times. I talked with him as recently as 2 weeks ago, saying, Andy, you really don't want to be in a position where you're taking orders from the military on tape that you've made of something that is a phenomena that needs to be shared with the world. And I personally feel this very strongly. He feels intimidated on one level by the military, which they're very good at doing. And
Linda, let me ask you a question.
I wouldn't have done any of what I've done in my life if I'd been intimidated by every time I've been approached.
I think, Linda, that in Britain they do have some laws that we don't have here. They don't have the same constitutional rights that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes, and he brings that up. But I still insist that he
How did they intimidate him? Exactly what did they say?
He says that they said to him very specifically that they did not want him to show or distribute this videotape. And my response is that he did it as a private citizen, and that if he gets the tape out for other people in the world to see, what is he doing except showing a phenomena that people need to see, and he's not doing anything that is violating any kind of military operation that was formal. Whatever this helicopter is dropping down in between on the field, we've seen that kind of operation many times. In fact, when I was over there, there was one afternoon when several of us were out photographing a helicopter that had started over the East Field, the famous East Field, in the morning, and we could clearly see a number on this helicopter, and it had a very unusual color combination, which we later learned was a very specific branch of the British Army has a yellow, very bright canary yellow and a very dark helicopter, so it looks very strange in the sky. And the numbers through our telephoto lenses we could see very clearly. And this went on, Art, for 6 hours. And we ended up seeing four different numbers. All the helicopters looked the same, except the numbers kept changing. And what did these four helicopters do over 6 hours? They made a square, we called it a square route, between the Eastfield, West Stowell, Pickett Hill, and Woodboro Hill. And it was the area between Pickett Hill and Woodboro Hill that Andy videotaped the six lights, the helicopter coming down into the field, and a series of another dramatic event that I was participating in on August 13th, which I'll tell you about in a few minutes. But why would four helicopters make this round of these four areas over 6 hours?
Because the government's involved.
We think that they're monitoring.
Yeah.
That there's a clear monitoring.
Obviously they're involved.
And so there's something that is given off when these lights appear. People who live there say that you can count on it. If you see the light, you're going to see helicopters.
So they have a way then of monitoring the presence. Maybe they receive a signal. Maybe they've got radar that tells them something's around. Some sort of something tells them it's happening over here.
Well, if anybody listening in this large coast audience has any firsthand intelligence or government knowledge about exactly what kind of satellite or what kind of machinery we're using to pick up the frequencies on these lights, I would sure like to hear about it. And for people who may or may not be comfortable in communicating by email, at least a first contact, I can be reached at earthfiles@earthfiles.com. That's my email address, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And I would welcome hearing from anyone out there who may think that they have some solid information.
I can tell you how to get some solid information, Linda.
Yeah.
You put somebody out there in the field with not just a video camera, but with a frequency counter and a spectrum analyzer, and you'll have your answers. The minute something appears, I guarantee you'll have your answers. Those will look across a range of a very, very wide range of frequencies, and you will find out where there's an emission.
Well,
it's that easy, really.
Yeah, and this is leading to what I was going to tell you about one of two dramatic eyewitness events that I myself, it's the first time that I ever saw things so strange, and it has to do with looking at things in frequencies that are not UV light. And before I go to that, I just want everybody to know that they can read Andy's story about this experience of the six lights on videotape and the helicopter at my report, my news report, August 19th under Real X Files. I did about 25 news reports based on crop formations just last summer to fall alone. And this one was August 19th, and it's called White Balls of Light and Helicopter Videotaped in Woodboro Hill Field. And you can go to that report and you can read Andy's own account. Now, this issue of trying to look at the fields in other frequencies outside of light, normal light.
Mm-hmm.
Last summer, a friend of mine, and we had gone to college together, and he had been keeping track of my reports on the radio and at earthfiles.com. And he got in touch with me, and he said, Linda, I know you're going to England, and he said, I've got a very expensive infrared starscope combination. It was a military spec, a very expensive instrument. And he said, I really want you to take it. And so
Are you talking about, for example, third generation night vision? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. You can look at things in infrared,
yes,
and you're gathering starlight,
yes,
and with a magnification that was, I could look out across a field that was otherwise pitch black with fog, and I was seeing the grains of wheat,
sure,
on the head.
Sure. I have such instruments, Linda. They they absolutely work in the way that you just described, and they amplify light in excess of 90,000 times.
That's right. And so that very day I was telling you that we were out photographing and watching and trying to figure out why were these four helicopters very low making this strange route, and we said to ourselves, look, something, they must be picking up something. So tonight, let's stay out in the East Field as long as we can. This was a very cold summer in England as compared to the year before that was so hot. And we were having the problem that it was very difficult to stay out all night because it was so cold. But we said, let's park at the East Field. There were seven of us. We showed up. And there had been a lot of rain, and there had been flash flooding. It was very bizarre weather last summer. And when we got there, there was low fog over the East Field extending down to West Stoll. And along those fields, people who you get mysterious lights and crop circles, you'll see maps that show how these ridges of hills that have Mesopotamian connections extend along these fields that I'm now referring to as East Field and West Stoll. And across the road is the famous Woodboro Hill and Pickett Hill.
Yes.
And these fields have had probably as much or more crop formation activity as any field in the world for some reason over the last 10, 12, 15 years. So we're parked now. There's seven of us. And there's multiple cars. And I've got this Starscope infrared. Everybody else, every person has got videotape and or 35 millimeter, and there were some tripods, and we're really there trying to see what's going to show up, if anything, but we're in anticipation because of all the helicopter activity. So the fog is settling in so thick that the blackness is a blackness that I don't personally think I've ever seen anywhere I've lived in the United States. It's very difficult to get across to industrialized urban areas that you can be out in a farm country, and if there's no moon, and if there is fog, you're in a black that is just so black, which is going to make even more startling what I'm telling you. A hole opened up in the sky, almost as if you were in an observatory, and we could see clear stars through this circle hole above us, but everything else in all directions was pitch black. And I pick up the Starscope infrared, and I'm looking now toward West Stoll, and it's across the East Field and across all of these crops. And remember, there had been flash flood that day, and all of the, any roads, any of the rural roads, there was one that went in between the fields going out maybe
About 1 minute, Linda.
Okay, lots of water. We knew no one was out there. And when I pick up and look through my infrared into the blackness, I couldn't believe that suddenly, out of nowhere, pops in a glowing oval. And not only is it glowing, it begins to hop in the frame with me holding the frame absolutely steady. And what happens next, as I pass this around, and all seven of us are absolutely astonished because the blackness is so black, and yet in the infrared Starscope, we are seeing something oval, bright, flickering, and it's moving, and then it transforms.
Transforms?
Yes.
Into?
That's what I'll tell you after the break.
you're learning how to do this, Linda. All right, with her own eyes. She is an objective, very, very, very careful reporter. Skeptic all the way. So if Linda says she saw this, you can place money on that one. She saw it. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. I'll tell you about that book one more time when we get back. Don't touch that dial.
What will you do when you're lonely? No one waiting by your side. You've been alone.
Overnight,
Kingdom of Nye. From west of the Rockies, dial 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222 or use the wildcard line at 1-775-727-1295. To reach Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903.
I live among the creatures of the night.
I certainly do. Good morning. Well, you're hearing a pretty dramatic program tonight, if you're listening carefully. Maybe even if you're just listening casually, it's damn dramatic. Take a look at that crop circle, the one she's talking about. I won't hold you up very long here because we've got to get to the rest of the story, and I know you want to. The transformation. By the way, I do have to interject this. You are aware of the Bigelow Foundation, right? And you're aware their research has gone into the infrared. A lot of what they've seen at the ranch, which we don't identify, including a portal opening, was seen in the infrared. Remember? Anyway, Linda's new book is not quite out yet. It'll be in the stores soon. This is a one-time offer for all of you. It's called Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles. You can get an autographed copy. It's going to be your only opportunity to do that before it hits the stores. Pretty attractive idea, huh? The number to call is 1-800-864-7991. That's 1-800-864-7991. You can call right now, and you've got 24 hours to get through. So if it's busy, don't get frustrated. Just wait a little while and try again. All right, no delay. We really got the work up here, and we've had the pause, and now the transformation, if you please.
Yes, and you can see what I'm describing if you're still in that Real X-Files section, and you go to the August 26th report, Pulsing Jumping Light in Westall, England Field, and you will see my own drawings, and you will see photographs of the one of the helicopters that I was telling you about, close-up showing one of the numbers on the side, showing it as it was approaching the field and why we were out there that night. And I'm passing my infrared starscope around. There's seven of us. Everybody is seeing this jumping the oval, and I try to do a drawing at the site that would show what it looks like through the kind of gray-green night vision scope.
Okay, Linda, hold on. I'm back at your site. Where do I go, please?
You go to August 26th.
No, Real X-Files?
Yeah, Real X-Files.
Okay. And then
August 26th.
August 26th.
And it should say Pulsing Jumping Light in Westall.
Yep.
And when you go there, you're going to see what we were seeing in the day, the helicopter, and how it was going over the field. And then you will see my depiction of the jumping oval that we saw between 1 a.m. and 1:30 a.m.
I can't get in. Your website won't let me go any further, Linda. It's too crowded.
Too many people trying to get in.
Too many people, yeah. So anyway, you go.
Well, it'll clear up, and at about 1:30, three of us thought that we saw an orange beam pop into view in all of that black fog. I saw it. Everybody said at the same time, oh, my God, did you see that beam? Well, I don't know. Maybe it was because we'd been up for 18 hours and it was cold, but it was exciting. I just said to the darkness, whatever you are, why don't you come closer so we can see what you are clearly? And I'm admitting this. I said this out loud. Everybody heard me, and I did it sort of in a lighthearted way. And immediately, because I raised the infrared scope back up to my eye as I said it, immediately the oval flared up extremely bright in this lens, and it turned into a square of flickering brightness. And at the time, I thought to myself, my gosh, this looks just like if I had a perfect square mirror and I was showing it up to the sun, and the reflection off of a square mirror, that's what it looked like jumped into the scope. And simultaneously, my friends, they were all yelling that they could see a red light flare up. I'm looking through the lens.
Sure.
They're saying that they're seeing red light out there in that pure black mist.
Sure, and you're seeing it like crazy.
And I'm seeing this thing transforming into the square and pulsing, 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 and it starts getting these double rings around it, which I tried to depict at the website as well. And I know that you get a circle around an infrared object, but this had two, and they seem to be pulsing. And everybody said, Linda, keep talking to it. So I kept saying, whatever you are, we're not afraid. Please come so we can see you closer. Well, this is the amazing thing. This square, whatever it transformed from the oval to the square, kept pulsing for at least another 20 minutes.
You know, you really called to it like that?
We did, yes. I said it out loud,
Linda,
and everybody else started saying it out loud.
You know, Linda, that's how good-looking women get mutilated in the movies all the time.
Well, all I know is I didn't feel any fear at all. I was curious. I was provoked. I have never seen anything like this in my entire life. Neither had anybody else, and they all get to see it through the StarScope, too. So we all saw everything that I'm telling you. And then at about 10 minutes till 2, because we had all tracked, we figured this whole thing went on for about one solid hour, and in about 10 minutes till 2, the energy, as if it were excited, that's what we all felt. It was as if we were dealing with something that became extremely excited and sustained a sense that we all felt of something out there that we couldn't see except through this StarScope that had an excitement about its pulsing. And then, almost as if it were tired, that's probably characterizing it too much, but it began to slow, and I was watching through the scope when it went back from the square to the oval. And I remember it startled me so much because it was like watching something that was alive, but it wasn't like anything that you had any precedence in your mind for.
No reference
whatsoever. And it went into the pulsing oval, and it began to jump in the frame, almost reminding me of music that was fading out the same way it had come in. And it was doing the jumping, and all of a sudden, it was a jump, and it was gone, and no more. And we stayed out there for about another 30 minutes, waiting, hoping for whatever one hopes of having more understanding of what you've seen for an hour, and you don't grasp, except that you, all seven of us, we all agreed that we felt there was intelligence there. It's back to that where you stare at an animal, and it is truly intelligent, and you know it's there, but you don't understand what has occurred. Well, that happened, and hopefully everyone will be able to see these images that I drew, because they're really pretty close to what I was seeing through the StarScope. That occurred on, it was Monday, July 31st. Or, no, on August 3rd. That's right. Thursday, August 3rd is where that happened. Well, now you go another week, and you get to where the night before I was to leave back for the United States, and Andy Buckley, the fellow who had taken this astonishing videotape that I had seen, he and a friend and I, we all went up to Woodboro Hill that night. And this was on August 12th. And it was around 10:30, and in the field, the same field that he had videotaped from Pickett Hill and that the helicopter had come down to, was still a completely beautiful, virgin field for most of it, with the exception of one kind of an oval that had come early in the season toward the top of the hill. All of the sweeping field down below was completely pristine, and we're up there, and I'm looking through the starscope. I'm looking out into the field. I'm running it down all of the tram lines. There's nothing. You could see people. I could identify people's faces a half a mile away through this scope, and there was nothing in that field. And the first thing that happened was that we, the three of us, noticed that there were odd orangish lights that seemed to be appearing in the sky going toward Pickett Hill. And all of a sudden, for some reason, I had my starscope and a camera, and Andy had his videotape, and he was trying to get it on to a tripod. And his friend Hazel, we were all sort of looking in three different directions, and I turned toward the hills straight across from Woodboro Hill, which would be toward the east field, and those hills that went along the fields where we had seen this pulsing light. I just looked that way, and I don't know how to explain this, because it just seems like it popped in, and it was the strangest orange. You'd have to go to a pumpkin in Halloween to get the color. But once you said that's the color, the quality of it, the only way I could describe it, and I said this at my website on the, it is Woodboro Hill. It's called Mysterious Light near Woodboro Hill. The night before August 13th, 2000 formation, that's at my Real X-Files section, and you can see what appeared in the sky that I tried to draw and had the quality of a kind of laser light, the way a laser shimmers. This wasn't solid, and it wasn't translucent. It was a very bizarre orange-quality light, and it had embedded in it a little white light on the right side and a yellow larger light on the left side. And Andy was trying to get his camera focused on it. I'm looking at it through both my camera lens and the starscope, passing back and forth with Hazel. And we are amazed when this transforms into what I show at the website. And if you had a 4th of July sparkler that exploded into red and white pulsing sparklers that stayed in exactly the same place in the sky doing a rotation, red, red, white, red, red, white, that's what happened. That's what I saw in the lens of my camera when it exploded. Hazel was looking through the starscope, and this thing was pulsing in the sky going from the orange strange laser light into this red pulsing light, and Andy, finally, I heard him, "I've got it. I've got it in the lens," and as soon as his voice was uttered, this thing started to move, and it started to move going south over the tops of the hills. I'm following it. Hazel's following it. Andy is trying to follow it, and in fact, he got about 2 seconds of it on videotape that I saw later. But whatever was happening between this thing and us, it was like it was moving almost as Andy felt that it did, it not to be videotaped. I mean, that's the sense that he had. And we watched this keep doing this pulsing until it seemed to literally disappear in the darkness to the south. There were clouds, and because it was so bright, you're talking about something that was so intense through the lenses that it was almost like hurting your eyes, but not quite. So we expected that as it went south and there were some clouds, we fully expected to see it come out from behind the clouds. If this entered, if it was a structure that entered the clouds, it never came out. We stayed up there for quite a while. And then when we left, I had looked down in the field. It was midnight. There was nothing in that field. There were no people, there were no lights, there was nothing in the tram lines.
Gotcha. So in other words, the investigator, you, who's been reporting on this and talking to eyewitnesses for years and years and years that I've been interviewing you, Linda, had it happen to her.
Yeah,
now, what I'm curious about, Linda, is through all this, when it finally happened to you and you became not just a listener to eyewitnesses, but an eyewitness How did that affect you?
It stays with you in a funny, strange way that is not, it's not really quite describable. I think I'm slightly haunted by these events because I always am trying to get to the bottom of things. I'm always trying to understand things, and most everything you do get explanations for. But these hang on as so strange.
Yes.
With that sense of intelligence that you feel, this palpable intelligence, and it does haunt you. And 6 hours later or so, I get a knock in the bed and breakfast where I'm staying.
Oh.
Linda, there's a formation at Woodboro Hill. And that's where I had just been.
Oh, my.
And I just couldn't believe it. I had just gotten out of a shower. I was, my hair was wet, everything, and I just tore out. We went over to Woodboro, and I couldn't believe it. And I can still remember this feeling of running up that hill, running in disbelief. No, it couldn't be. I was looking with my own eyes midnight. And you get up there and you look down, and at my website, the formation that is at that story of August 17th, it's August 17th when I reported it. It says August 13th in the byline. It is an extraordinary, it looks like the center of a sunflower with all the seeds, and this was very large. And here it was in the very place that we had been looking, and there was nothing there just a few hours before. And that really astonished me, Art. When we went down into the formation and we walked, some people said, well, it has such a strange lay that maybe a team of people came out into the field and did this one. And we said, well, it would have to have been between midnight and 4:30 a.m., because when you're in England in the summer, the sun, the sky is light, easily light, at 3:45 to 4 a.m.
Oh, yes.
And the sun, the twilight of the sky, it is still an orchid color into 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night. We were there at midnight, and we know there was nothing there at midnight, and the sky was light somewhere around 4-ish. Now, to look at the formation that is photographed there, as big as it is, and for any team of people to have made that in 4 hours or 5 hours is not possible, even based on the NBC team that took those guys down to New Zealand.
Yes.
And had them with NBC covering it. If you took the number of men times the number of hours, it exceeded 30 man hours in the creation of that very stilted thing that they showed on
right.
the Discovery Channel.
You're right.
Now we're looking at something that is fluid, beautiful, fractal, incredible, complicated, and we know that nothing was there at a little after midnight when we left.
Linda, when you go from investigator to experiencer, which is what you did, does it affect your objectivity, do you think?
I hope not. I think that what I can say firmly is that I am not blown like a windsock when strange characters or people come out of the woodwork and announce that they have evidence, quote unquote, that 80% of formations are a hoax. Why those strange statements emerged in the summer of 2000, I do not know. I'm very suspicious of the
sources. I think I know. Yes, I think I know, and I think we agree.
Yeah, and somebody wanted the world to focus on, quote-unquote, the hoaxes in England without ever emphasizing the fact that 2000 began in Spain, in Italy, the Czech Republic, Holland, Germany. They were playing a major role, not just England.
All right, gotcha. Hold on, Linda. Into the Light. That might be a good piece of bumper music for now. What do you think? Phone calls soon.
The mist across the window hides the light. The
side? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at area code 775-727-1222 or call the wildcard line at 775-727-1295. To talk with Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is indeed, and we're about to open up the phone lines. In fact, you can consider them open right now. You've heard it from Linda. And for the first time, you've heard Linda explain what she has personally seen versus what she has investigated. It really is an unusual thing to happen to you. As you know, I talked about this kind of thing for a long time, and then one day, my wife and I saw the real thing. And you're never the same after that happens. Not once you've seen it yourself. There's always a slight seed of doubt, no matter how many eyewitnesses you've talked to. But once you've seen it with your own eyes, something inside changes and will forever be changed. And that happened to Linda. At any rate, we're going to the phones here shortly. So if you have a question about any of the range of subjects we've covered, it's a good time now. It can happen that fast. All right, well, we're going to the phones now, but there are two quick questions by Fast Blast, and you're welcome to ask them that way as well if you wish, that I really want to get in. I understand the frustration. Tad in Kirby, Oklahoma says, fine, it's real. What the hell does it mean? And I know we don't really have an answer for that, do we?
No, in detail I don't, but at the bigger level of an answer, I really honestly think that we are dealing with something that is in the unseen, but that is connected to that part of us that we might call our spirit-soul complex.
All right. Well,
and I get into some of that in the book, and it's difficult, I know, for late-night talk.
But it is.
There is something very profound, I think, going on, and I just hope everybody listening will get this book and then read about, we'll call it the spirit field.
It's a lot harder for daytime talk. Listen, here's another one. Art, look. I just can't believe that aliens would travel millions of miles to draw in our crop fields. Surely, there are better ways to contact us. What do you think? Well, who says it's aliens who have come millions of miles? First of all, if anything, we're sort of leaning away from that, it seems to me, in what we're hearing today. And secondly, if it is an intelligence, as a dolphin would be intelligent, it would not know how to communicate with us now, would it? Linda, here come the phone calls. First time caller line, you're on the air with Linda Moulton Howe. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. This is Steve in Portland.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hi. Actually, I've got a question for her, and I've got an answer for you.
All right.
The question is, Linda, I ordered your book, by the way. It took me forever to get through, though.
Oh, good, thanks.
And they said it would be autographed, so I'm waiting. The question was there also any simultaneous activity going on, say, in some of the other spots, like at Salisbury Hill, and for Art?
Wait, take your answer. Hold on.
Okay.
Now, you mean during my stay in last summer when these events were happening, were there other things happening in other areas?
Yes. Were there any other simultaneous either circles or sightings or any other things like that?
Oh, yes. In Hampshire, this summer, some very dramatic formations and events happened in Hampshire, and what I've been describing was focused in Wiltshire because that's where I was. But
simultaneously, Linda?
Yeah, there will be things happening. In fact, in the book, I went through many, many of the records at CropCircleConnector.com and I found more than once, but one night, in which seven formations occurred over three counties in England.
Oh, well, there's your answer, and you have a question or an answer for me.
Yes, at MSNBC.com / news.
Yes.
/ 285231.
Okay, hold on before you give me all that.
Okay, sorry about that.
What?
It is a Dateline story called Hot Wheels by John Hockenberry, and it has video and interview with Dean Kamen about the iBot.
Yes, oh, iBot. All right. All right. Thank you very much. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Linda Moulton Howe. Good morning.
Hello. This is Mike from Modesto. I have a question for Linda, but I do have something for you out first if you're interested on what Marco Polo means.
What does it mean?
It's a child's game. You play in a small room. Somebody puts on a blindfold, yells Marco, and everybody else has to yell Polo, and then he's got to try to tag the person following their voice, and if he tags somebody, then they have to wear the blindfold.
Why did you tell me all that?
From the Ghost Voices. Remember?
Oh, yes. Oh, that's right, from the electronic voice phenomena. Yes, go ahead with Linda.
Okay. I have a question. In your book, Glimpses of Other Realities, High Strangeness, Volume 2.
Right.
Is a part concerning Linda Porter about the silhouette beings coming out of the vortex.
Right.
Now, the story right after that leads into a secret base in California. Now, did these beings take her to that base, or is this a different story?
That was her impression. And we are now in the area that is so difficult when you get into the human abduction syndrome of the of Linda herself not understanding how she could be somehow in a very classified military corporate structure underground, could describe it in detail, has drawn many more drawings for me actually than what I've even put in the book, felt that she was going to places that were off, that very few people had access to, but somehow she thought the non-humans were taking her second body or out of body or whatever you want to call it and making her see all of this stuff that she could never access in her matter body. And how that works, I don't know, except that it has been described by so many people over the last 30 or 40 years that you have to at least listen with an open mind.
Okay, they took her astral body to this facility?
That's what she thinks.
Okay, because I've encountered the same beings, and they've taken me out astrally, but I've never gotten beyond my home boundary, and I physically remember them doing this, and I know hers was brought under hypnosis when I was like, you know, oh my God, you know, that's why I believe her stories, because I've actually seen them physically do it. My first impression is that they were higher beings, but now all of a sudden I got this feeling that there's some sort of military or involvement. You know what I'm saying?
Well, you certainly can't discount the possibility of a connection.
A conflict. See, Linda's story and many of the stories in Glimpses Volume 2 are a sense that there is a struggle, a conflict, just as the sense in the crop circles that there's a point-counterpoint. I'm not going to try to characterize it. I'm just saying there's a conflict. There seems to be some kind of either a dispute, a political disagreement, trying not to use loaded words, that there is something not resolved at a bunch of levels, and that the non-human story seems to be a part of it. The crop circles seem to be a part of it. I think that we're at some kind of a crossroads that's extremely important, and humans are not understanding it.
Mm-hmm. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Linda Moulton Howe. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, where are you, sir?
I'm in Michigan, Clarkston, Michigan.
All right.
Linda, some of these crop circles are very intricate works of art. Don't you feel that it is quite a gift to witness something like that you witnessed there?
Oh, yes. It's extremely exciting, and when you're in the presence of something that is not quite comprehensible, it does touch you in a way, as Art was saying, that you're never the same again, and I am grateful that whatever this is, I seem to have in this life a role of trying to understand it and communicate it. And therefore my focus on a variety of these subjects is sort of as an observer, but as an observer who is trying to understand it, and so there is an excitement to have even a little bit more closer involvement. So I am grateful.
Right. Also, I was reading a book and your name was brought up. Tom Adams, does that ring a bell?
Oh, yeah. Known Tom a long time.
and the San Luis Valley area stuff that goes on there.
That's right. Tom Adams and Gary Massey were two of the first people in the country to investigate the unusual animal deaths referred to as mutilations all the way back in the 60s.
Wow, that's really something. And also I heard the area could have portholes and things like that.
Down in the San Luis Valley?
Yeah.
No one understands that area. It is truly strange. It has been strange going back into Indian lore. When you're down there, I've been all over it. The Sangria de Cristo Mountains, that's a big range there, and Mount Blanca rises up above an area where there have been mutilations, there have been lights, there have been strange, all kinds of strange things. I talked to a man who said that he heard music coming up out of an area where he was hiking. Other people have heard machinery. No one understands why are there all of these strange sounds that come out of the tops of those mountains, and why is it that down in the valley, if you took this whole state of Colorado, based on 20 years of research, there are three or four areas that I would say are chronically involved with some kind of high strangeness. And the area of the San Luis Valley, along the Sangrias and where the sand dunes are, over to Alamosa, is one of them.
All right.
Thank you, Linda.
Okay, thank you. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Linda Morton Howe. Hello.
Good morning, Art, and good morning, Linda.
Hello.
Dave from Whitefish, Montana.
Oh.
I lived about a mile away from that one up here in Whitefish about 2 years ago.
Yeah, last year and the year before.
Yeah, I didn't see that one last year. I seen the one 2 years before. It was a simple one, kind of like you say.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that it was the identical symbol 2 years in a row in fields 7 miles apart. And if it hadn't been for Melody Watts, I don't think any of us would know that the formation occurred. She's the one who kept looking, and she's the one who found, and she's the one who went to the farmer.
Well, I passed that area every day, and I seen it the morning that it appeared, and it looked very, like, sloppy compared to the ones I seen in pictures and books and stuff.
Yes, and that is the case in the United States. None of us understand.
Do you think,
the remotest areas, they look sloppy.
And, you were talking earlier before that a young boy touched the grass that was bent and it was warm.
Yes, the soil in the sand.
I would like to have your input on then why don't we have snow circles?
Why do we have snow circles?
Why don't we have them?
Oh, there have been circles in ice and snow, not only here in North America, but in Europe.
As a matter of fact, we've got an example of an ice circle on my website right now. I know it's one that you know about, Linda.
Yes, and do you want to take that 2 minutes or minute 45 to hear that description by
yes.
This is Jim Rafferty. He lives in Delta, Ontario, Canada. This, what you're going to hear, he found, he was going out to feed his cows, and it was about December 1, 2000, just a few months ago. And for people wanting to know where Delta is, if you think in your mind where Ottawa is, and you go 50 miles west, you'll be sort of where Delta is. And this is December 1st, and Mr. Lafferty is walking toward his cows, and here he goes.
In my backyard is a fairly large pond, and as I was going over the bridge beside the pond, I noticed this clear circle around 20 feet across, and it was turning very slowly. And it was turning, I think, because of the current from the small creek that was just touching the edge of the circle. Now, the circle was all clear ice. There was no signs of any pieces. Now, the rest of the pond was more white-colored ice.
And so what you're saying is that in more opaque ice in the pond was a perfect circle that looked very clear and appeared to actually be turning amidst the other whiter, more opaque ice.
It was turning, and it was a perfect circle. There wasn't a flaw anywhere in it. There was approximately, I'd say, a quarter of an inch. Separating from the main ice to this circle. And it was just turning so slow. I would say it was most likely taking five minutes or more to make a complete circle.
And so this implies that the entire clear circle had somehow been cut out from the surrounding ice.
Yeah. And there wasn't a mark on the pond where anybody had ever been walking on it or anything like that, you know.
Well, has anybody discussed the possibility of something coming from the air, some kind of unidentified craft, and actually landing on the ice?
Well, actually, I don't think the ice would have held much. It was only, I'd say, 2 to 3 inches thick at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was something.
Isn't that an extraordinary description?
Yes, it is. It certainly is, yes. That's amazing, Linda. Absolutely amazing. And so the bottom line answer to the questions that you get like this would be, there are snow circles, there are ice circles, and guess what, folks? There's even dirt circles. You remember some photographs we had some years ago, Linda?
Ed and Chris Sherwood in California went out, and it was so elaborate. It was, remember, it had about 14 or 16 of these spokes coming around a circle.
I sure do.
And what got me, and I shared this at the time privately with Ed and Chris, but I don't think that there's any reason why not to say that I was involved in the investigation of an amazing abduction case. It had actually occurred in the 70s. I didn't come into the investigation until the early 80s. The man who was affected by the, I think it was clearly a physical body being taken, not out of body, for a bunch of reasons that are too long to go into, but he ended up being obsessed with drawing what looked like star maps at the time, and one of his maps is almost identical to what was laid in that California dirt that we've all seen those photographs that Ed and Chris Sherwood took.
Sure. All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Linda Moulton Howe. Hello.
Hi, this is Anthony in Fairbanks.
Fairbanks, Alaska. Yes,
yes.
Anthony. How you doing?
Hi, yes. I had a question. I heard some time ago in stories about crop circles and investigators that some people, when they've spent time inside of crop circles, have later gone on and had what could be described as paranormal activity that seems to follow them home.
Mm-hmm.
Did that ever really happen, or was that just rumors? Or
there is such a wide spectrum of human emotion and mental thoughts, and what people describe as their ability to even see more around them, meaning frequencies, that it's hard to know from person to person. I had a very strange and interesting experience in the summer of 2000 of being out on an experiment with Ed and Chris Sherwood specifically to flash camera flashes at the center of a formation, and then meaning taking photos while we did the flashes to see if we would get pictures of any of these translucent spheres, of which I show several dozen in the book. And it's not clear exactly what these translucent spheres are that show up in so many of the photographs from crop formations. Dr. Levengood, the biophysicist in Michigan, thinks that it's related to plasmas. What is provoking the plasmas is unclear. It would have to be, I guess, in the category of a low-energy plasma, and there's controversy about that.
Yeah, but if that's on you personally, Linda, he's asking about.
Yeah, and get the idea of trying to take these photographs and suddenly seeing lights in the sky or in the air around us, and then when we leave this experiment and everybody's sort of buffaloed by what are we seeing when we do the flashes of the camera, and then we're walking back to the cars and it's perfectly dark, and all of us seem to be seeing lights around us that we had not seen before. And I'm not talking about big lights. I'm talking about small, subtle things. And I don't understand it. I don't know if it's something that goes on between the eye and the brain mechanism, and it lasts for a while, or that you become permanently opened up in a different way. I don't know.
All right, Linda, we're at the top of the hour, and I always ask my guests if they would like to remain for the final hour, or I know it's after or near 5 o'clock there now, you could get to bed and I can do open lines. Your choice.
I'm happy to keep going.
All right. Keep going we shall then. Stay right where you are. Yes, from investigator, years and years and years, to experiencer. You know, I had no idea this was coming tonight. No idea at all. So, welcome to the club, Linda. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM.